along at a rapid pace, and it's an awful lot of money to be spending at one time, I mean. Then I told him about Tom LaSalle and how I'd thought I'd have weeks, but now realized that I had only days, even hours, to think about it. So what do you think? Could I be biting off more than I can chew? I know it's a little late to have second thoughts, but I'd like to know what you think.
Well, he said, straightening up in his chair and putting his mind to the problem, property in that area is a good investment, and you have the funds to buy it. But what are you going to do with it when you get it?
We haven't thought that far, Sam laughed.
Empty houses deteriorate, you know, but the owners might want to rent them back.
Mildred thinks we should tear down two of them.
Really?
Sam asked, raising his eyebrows.
As much as she likes to redo and redecorate?
The problem with that, I said, is that if we restored them to resell, we'd be right back where we are now, unable to control who buys them. For all we know, Ridgetop could slip back in and buy them from us, if they wanted them bad enough.
They want them pretty bad now,
Sam said, cocking one eyebrow.
I really got an earful down at the Bluebird today. Word is they are planning to build something like a boutique hotel.
A boutique hotel? What in the world for? Of all the harebrained ideas, that took the cake. And what makes a hotel boutique anyway?
As far as I know, Sam answered, it implies small, expensive, and exclusive. The rumor is that it'll be one story of lobby, meeting rooms, and spa, and two upper floors of luxury rooms and suites, and an upscale restaurant on the roof for the view.
Oh, for goodness sake, I said. What view? Mr. Pickens mowing his lawn? And what kind of people would come to Abbotsville for a luxury vacation? Hikers and bikers and backpackers? Then I answered myself, not likely. Sam smiled in agreement.
Sounds a little far-fetched, doesn't it? But Joe Higgins, you know him? He heard they'll plant mature trees all around the block so there'd be treetop dining.
I rolled my eyes at the thought of having dinner with squirrels, birds, and a few bats and mosquitoes. And what about parking? That's a large block, but not that large, even with every house on it bulldozed to the ground.
Well, there's a rumor that they'll petition the commissioners to close off the side streets and extend the block that way. If they did that and got rid of Pickens, they'd have plenty of space for whatever they wanted to do.
And who are they? I asked, springing to my feet in agitation. That's what I want to know. And where's the money coming from for something like that? I mean, who is Ridgetop anyway?
Well, according to your friend Callie, from what I heard today, it seems that Pete Hamrick is in it up to his neck.
I could attest to the truth of that, but chose not to, not wanting to reveal where and how I'd come by the information.
And, Sam went on, I'm guessing a whole lot of small investors, all with fingers in the pie from the sound of it, with one or two outsiders with deep pockets. Maybe a hotel chain as a primary backer.
I whirled around to stare at him, struck by one possibility. Small investors, like the county commissioners?
Sam nodded. Could be, and possibly a few Bluebird customers who were unusually quiet today. Julia,
Sam went on soberly,
I don't want to throw cold water on your plans. It's your money, and you can use it as you please. But you and Mildred should be aware of what you're up against. From what I heard today, this Ridgetop outfit is looking at a multi-million-dollar enterprise that'll certainly fit the bill as being in the public interest. A case could easily be made that it'll raise the commercial value of the surrounding area, as well as having huge job potential both during and after construction. The future of Jackson Street could be as a secondary Main Street, full of shops, gas stations, mini malls. A lot of people will see that as a public benefit and fight you tooth and nail.
Well, A lot of people have eyes bigger than their stomachs, too. It's plain foolishness to think that a so-called boutique hotel will revitalize that area, much less the whole town. As far as I'm concerned, Mildred and I will be doing a public service by keeping that historic area as it is. Except, of course, I said with a sigh, the Cochrane House is a group home. Sunday afternoon, and I had taken myself up to the guest room to finish wrapping Christmas gifts, hoping that doing something constructive would have a calming effect. Not only was I anxious about buying three houses out from under a few possibly major players, my mind was still churning with what Sam had learned at the Bluebird. Even if half the rumors were true, Mildred and I were up against some heavy lifters, and all we had was skinny Tom LaSalle. But also, I encouraged myself, a sneak attack scheduled for Tuesday afternoon when we would become the owners of the desired properties. But I knew that there could be many a slip twixt cup and lip, and all I could do was hope for the best. But if we could hold on till then, Ridgetop would have to fold their tents and look for another town to ruin, because a ruination was what their plans would create. In a few years of fewer and fewer guests, I mean, what did Abbotsville have to offer luxury overnighters? A boutique hotel would be lucky to end up as a Motel 6. "Knock, knock," Lloyd said, rapping on the door and bringing me back to the present. "Can I come in?" "Oh, wait a minute," I called, hurriedly covering the gift I was wrapping. "Now you may. Come on in." "What's going on, honey?" I asked, knowing that when he sought me out, something was on his mind. "Well," he said, "you know Freddie Pruitt? He's having a hard time 'cause he can't study at his aunt's house. She's got a bunch of little kids, and he's like me. He needs a quiet place to study. So he was kind of looking forward to moving in next door, but now he's worried about studying with a bunch of big kids living there, too." "Oh, dear. I couldn't study under those conditions either." "No'm, me neither." Then, with a somber look on his face, he said, "You know, Miss Julia, it doesn't seem fair that I have two rooms to study in, and he doesn't even have one. When one gets too noisy, I can always move to the other one, but he can't." How in the world could I justify to this child the inequalities of life, while the do-gooders of the world clamored to level all the playing fields? And to do it in spite of the fact that when it had been tried before with completely leveled fields and everybody equalized, their efforts had ended up with no one having anything. "I know, honey," I said, "and I, too, occasionally worry about having more than a lot of people do, but when something comes along where a lot is needed, I'm awfully glad to have it." I thought of the properties Mildred and I were buying in order to save the home of people I loved, including the boy sitting across from me. "Yes'm, I guess so. It's just that Freddie said he'd like to sleep in a room all by himself just once in his life." "He will," I said, as a nebulous plan solidified in my mind. "I'm sure of it. You just remind Freddie that every time he opens a book to study, he's getting that much closer to a room and a whole lot more all his own." "Sam," I asked after Lloyd had left and I'd gone downstairs, where Sam was dozing in a wing chair, "how do you feel about going into debt?"
"What?" He came fully awake, sitting straight up. "You don't need to go into debt."
"No, not me. I mean you."
He laughed. "Depends on what for."
"Come take a ride with me. If you feel like it, I mean."
"I feel fine," he said, standing. "Let me get a coat. I can't wait to see what you're up to now."
So I showed him what Lisa Hudson had come up with. We drove across town and turned at the high school onto Wilson Avenue, a street lined with two- and three-story Victorian houses. Some of the houses had been converted to offices for lawyers, CPAs, and doctors, as attested to by numerous signs. Others had been divided into apartments, and two smaller ones housed offices for non-profit groups. I pulled to the side of the street. the car still running for the heat, and pointed to a 3-story gray house with white gingerbread trim, a front porch, and a turret. The front yard sloped to the street, but the house itself was on level ground, and there was a huge tree in the backyard. A for sale sign was out front. "That one," I said. "Let's buy it."
"How much and what for?"
"They've reduced the price. It's too big for most uses. And it'd be for the homes for teens." Sam started laughing.
"Julia," he finally said, "you're too much. You've been trying to run Madge and her crew off, and now you want to put them in a house like that?"
"It's perfect, Sam. It has a new furnace, the roof is only 5 years old, and as you can see, the area's zoned for it. There's plenty of room for the boys to have rooms of their own without having to climb a ladder to get in a bunk bed. Besides, it's near enough that they can walk to school. And besides that, Binky says I need a tax write-off."
"And you want to go into debt?"
"No, not really. I don't know how much ready cash you have, so I was thinking more like you going in debt."
"Oh, you were you?"
"Well, since I'm buying those houses on Jackson, I thought you might want to, well, help out with this one. I'm not sure I can do it without selling something, and you know how I hate to do that."
"What are you thinking? Renting it to Madge or giving it to her? I mean, to the group?"
"Whichever you and Binky think best, but I'm not sure I want to just give it away. Especially to a group of people with as little foresight as they've exhibited so far."
"I'll tell you what I'll do,"
he said, leaning over to survey the house again.
"I'll come over tomorrow and have a look inside. It looks fine from here, but you never know. If it passes a close inspection, what about the two of us going in together? Wouldn't you like to have our picture in the paper as donors of a suitable house for the homes for teens?"
"I'll have to think about that," I said, recalling that miserable intervention where I'd been vilified for not supporting Madge's enterprise. "Our being acclaimed for good works ought to shame every one of them. I've never been inclined to seek publicity, as you know. In this case, however, I might not be averse to a little recognition. But, Sam, if we donated it, I'd want to be able to specify a few things Madge would have to agree to, and the main one is for little Freddie Pruitt to have a room of his own. I was thinking the top floor of the turret would be perfect. He could both study and sleep in peace and quiet in his own room."
"Then we'd better rent it to them with specific requirements spelled out in the lease."
"Then that's what we'll do, and we'll make the lease absolutely airtight. Although I doubt Madge would have it any other way." After a little further thought, I said, "Sam, let's forget about having our picture in the paper or being publicly recognized in any way. We're not even supposed to let our left hand know what our right hand is doing, much less let the whole town know."
"Suits me," Sam said, and yawned. "I never take a good picture anyway."
I laughed. "Me either. Besides, if it became known, we'd be flooded with requests from every non-profit in town and in the county, too." Chapter 46. Sam was as good as his word, contacting Lisa Hudson, the listing agent of the house on Wilson, the following morning and driving over to do a close inspection of the interior. While he was gone, I arranged funding of my share of the Great Dane Properties bank account, which Tom LaSalle had opened, checked in with Mildred to reassure myself, then sat back to await the outcome of our plans. On his return, Sam reported that the big Victorian could stand some updating. "But," he went on,
"it's certainly usable as it is. If Madge hasn't been too heavily influenced by HGTV restoration programs, she should be thrilled with it. Besides a kitchen, a living room, and a dining room, there are 2 rooms and a bath downstairs that could be a private space for the house parents, and a small parlor across from the living room off the front hall that could work for Madge's office. She'll love that.
And, he went on, 4 large bedrooms and a bath on the second floor, and 3 rooms and another bath on the third. It'll easily accommodate 7 boys, more if they double up.
I don't care how many they take in, just as long as they're not next door to Hazel Marie.
Then if that's what you want to do, I'll make an offer this afternoon.
But, I said, is it what you want to do?
Why not?
Sam said, as if he bought huge houses every day of the week.
It's for a good cause, and the location makes it a good rental investment if Madge's group folds, or a nice rebuild site in the future. Because, honey, if we do this, we need to look ahead and not lose control by giving it away. You may not know it,
but statistics show that the majority of startup nonprofits fail within the first 6 years.
What? You mean I've worried myself sick over the Cochrane House and it's likely to close up on its own?
No, not exactly. What usually happens is that the volunteers run out of steam and the funding dries up. The idea person moves on to other things after a year or so. So they'll hire a professional director who will serve as their fundraiser, as well as hiring an assistant director, a secretary or two, and probably a coordinator of volunteers. Then, as more and more money is required to pay salaries and raise funds, less and less is used for the stated purpose. That's when somebody will have the bright idea of turning the whole project over to a state or national organization and washing the hands of it.
Oh, my word, and walk away patting themselves on the back for doing so much good. Sam, we have got to get them away from the Pickenses before they turn that house into a thrift shop for the SPCA or a coalition of state-run soup kitchens. Sam smiled.
Not quite that bad, honey, but another possibility is that they'll sell it.
Sell what? They don't own the house. What would they sell, and who would they sell it to?
They could sell their name, their donor list, and any grants they may have gotten. And they could sell to private businesses that run things like elder care homes, child care centers, and so on all over the country. A lot of times these entities make money by, in turn, selling franchises to local people to run them. But whatever they do, it'll change the tone of the neighborhood and open the door for similar enterprises. The first thing, and you can count on Madge doing this, is to put a sign out front, and that sign will not only identify the house, it'll indicate that the neighborhood is in decline. A business of sorts has begun the invasion.
Thinking of a camel's nose, I said, we have to buy that big house, Sam, and get Madge and her crew out of the Cochrane House. The next thing will be to buy that. But if Pete Hamrick and his Ridgetop people get mad enough at us, they may hold on to it out of spite. Sam nodded.
Maybe. But when word gets out that their grand hotel plans have fallen through, Pete and Ridgetop will have their hands full with angry investors. They could be more than willing to unload it. Just sit tight, honey. Let's see what happens.
Well, what happened was that Tom LaSalle handed over deeds to the Pickrell, Osborne, and Winstead houses to Mildred and me late Tuesday afternoon, then left for Atlanta. About the same time, Sam sewed up the big Victorian and put Binky to work on an airtight lease. Talk about being house poor. It made me queasy just thinking about it. I had not seen or heard from Madge since spending some time in her holly bush, but somebody had told somebody else who had told Mildred that Madge was deeply depressed and would start crying whenever anyone asked her about the homes for teens. She'd lost heart, it was said, and had even stopped making fundraising phone calls. I had a twinge of conscience at that, but had to wait for Binky to finish wording the lease before she notified Madge that some big-hearted donors had come to the rescue. Sam and I had gone earlier to Binky's office to dictate the terms of the lease, which besides the usual legalities included the requirement that Freddie Pruitt be assigned the turret room for as long as he was in the care of Homes for Teens. We also made certain that the house was to be used as a home for homeless teens and for no other purpose, and that the lease would become null and void if the Homes for Teens was turned over to any other entity, nonprofit or not, regardless of how much good it did. I wanted to insert a requirement that Madge remain as director of the home and as president of the board of Homes for Teens just to keep her too busy to have any more enthusiastic nonprofit ideas. But Binky said we were skirting a legally binding lease already. That didn't concern me, though, for if Madge signed it, and I was sure she would, she'd either abide by the terms of the lease or I'd publish the lease for all to see how unlawfully inclined she was, which would certainly put a crimp in her fundraising ability. As far as I was concerned, she and Pete Hamrick were two of a kind, people for whom the rules didn't apply. So if it took a little sleight-of-hand chicanery to get the best of them, so be it. Then, just as I thought that we'd completed our end run around Ridgetop, succeeded in providing Madge a more suitable domicile, and emerged as contributors to the greater good in general, the town exploded. Everybody and his brother were raising the roof about one thing or another, having believed that their ships were about to come in, then realizing what a poor investment they'd made. But it all boiled down to having been gulled into Ridgetop's scheme of a luxury hotel. No one would admit to having bought into it, but there were a lot of grim faces and angry frowns around town. Two of the commissioners announced that they wouldn't stand for re-election, wanting, they said, to spend more time with their families. The newspaper went so far as to assign an intrepid reporter to track down the source of the uproar, but ended up with a short article titled, "Town Rife with Rumors," that was full of quotes by persons intent on anonymity. "We missed out," one unnamed source said, "and it's a dad-blamed shame. Omni International had big plans for us." Another claimed it had been the Europa chain, or maybe whoever it was who'd built a hotel in Abu Dhabi. And one source insisted that it had been the president himself who'd had his eye on Abbotsford for a unique boutique hotel. Mildred and I discussed the article in disbelief. "Can you believe," she asked, "what some people will fall for? Julia, we can pat ourselves on the back. We've saved these idiots from terminal disillusionment and future bankruptcy." "None of them would thank us," I said, "so it's a good thing we're hiding behind a corporate name." Great Dane Properties was identified in the article as the culprit that had dashed the hopes of the investors, none of whom would publicly admit to being one. "I just hope," one anonymous source said, "that whoever bought up that property has to eat dirt. They've stopped progress in its tracks." And thank goodness for that, I thought when I read it. Pete Hamrick, after threatening lawsuits against the Pickerels, Jan Osborne, and the Winsteads for failure to comply or some such thing, left for an extended vacation in Belize. That way he was able to avoid aggrieved investors and, I assumed, nurse his own grievances with tall drinks that came with miniature parasols. Madge Taylor, when offered the house on Wilson Avenue, did a complete about-face from sad and droopy to flying high again. Once more assured that what she wanted was what the Lord wanted too, she regained the sense of righteous purpose that marked whatever plan she concocted. Binky had called her in to announce the desire of an interested party to provide housing for the Homes for Teens, and Madge's face had lit up. "They're donating a place?" she'd cried. "Free and clear with no strings?" "Not quite," Binky had told her, then went on to tell her that the house was not a gift, but would be rented to Homes for Teens, Inc. "Then I want a lease," Madge had said, indicating that she could learn from experience. The next thing she said, Binky told me, was that she wanted it airtight because she'd learned to examine all gift horses in the mouth. I assured her that the donors felt the same way and told her that there would be no rent payments as such, but that she would be responsible for the property taxes. She didn't like that, but I told her that the donors were adamant that the Homes for Teens have some skin in the game. I'd smiled at that, because it had been Sam who'd insisted on their having skin in the game.
"That," he'd said, smiling at me, "is the way your man in Omaha puts it. Everybody accepts a part of the risk."
"So, of course," Binky had gone on, "she wanted to know who the donors were. Per the instructions of both of you, I didn't tell her, just reminded her of how much rent the interested party was foregoing. She signed it and left as happy as a lark, mostly, I think, for coming out better than Pete has. Her parting remark was that she just hoped the Cochran House would bankrupt Pete Hamrick for lying to her. 'He used us,' she told me, 'and I'm glad he's getting his own back. Everybody knows he's a snake oil salesman now.' 'Yes,' I said, agreeing with the assessment. 'And Binky, everybody knows that he used his position as a county commissioner to further his own interests, and that goes for the other commissioners, too. The sooner we get them all off the board, the better. And the new board, whoever they may be, should strengthen the zoning ordinances by specifying exactly what can go where and heavily penalizing anyone who tries to ruin a neighborhood by putting in something that will benefit the public. They need to recognize that neighbors are the public, too.' 'Then,' Binky said with a grin, 'maybe you should run for commissioner, Miss Julia.' 'Huh,' I said, smiling at the thought. 'Not me. I do my best work behind the scenes.'
"They're moving, Miss Julia." Hazel Marie's voice over the phone was filled with wonder. "Can you believe it? They're actually moving. A van's parked out front and they're taking out furniture. Oh, I can hardly believe it."
"Well, my goodness," I said. "Wonder what brought that about."
"I don't know, and I don't care. I'm just relieved to see them go. J.D. is convinced that his fence did it. A constant reminder, he said, that they weren't wanted. But I don't think they cared about that one way or the other."
She was right, I thought, for Madge Taylor was so wrapped up in her own virtue that she wouldn't recognize a snub if a wall went up around her.
Keeping up my cloak of anonymity, I asked, "Where are they moving to, Hazel Marie? Do you know?"
"Know 'em, and that's another thing I don't care about. Wherever it is will be better than next door to us, and if that's selfish and cold-hearted, I can't help it, although I do wish them the best.
We all do, Hazel Marie, and if it's a legal location, I'm sure they'll be all right."
"Well," she said with a sigh, "I guess now I'll have to worry about who'll move in next."
Cautioning her against worrying too much too soon, I brought the conversation to a close and immediately dialed another number.
"Mildred," I said when she answered, "we need to get Tom LaSalle back on the job. The Cochran House is being emptied as we speak."
Chapter 47. Even though a group home next to the Pickenses was no longer a source of contention, I couldn't get over the fact that my church, with full knowledge, had supported an illegal undertaking. And no one, not the preacher, not an elder or a deacon, much less an ordinary member, had acknowledged the lapse in judgment. So even though Sam continued to attend Sunday services at the First Presbyterian Church, I decided to absent myself by taking a sabbatical year. I had done all I could to inform the church leadership as to the nature of Madge's group, so it wasn't as if they hadn't known what they were doing. They chose, however, to ignore that information, so now I chose to ignore them. But with Christmas within sight, I had to admit that I was missing the church more than it appeared to be missing me. My absence from Sunday morning services had apparently drawn no particular notice, nor did my non-attendance at the special programs that the church offered throughout the season. I did, however, console myself by attending the First Baptist Church's presentation of Messiah and the Advent Spectacular, complete with drums and bagpipes, that Mildred's Episcopal Church offered to the community. It was strange, though, and unsettling, to have empty Sunday mornings when I had for so long had a church service to attend. I hardly knew what to do with myself during those times when I had normally occupied a pew in the sanctuary. It didn't, however, take long to adjust to having the time to drink a leisurely second cup of coffee and to begin reading Lloyd's Narnia books again. And I'll have to say that the stories about a lion far outweighed the movie reviews I'd been getting from the pulpit. Sam, bless his heart, never indicated in any way that he was disappointed in my decision to sit out the services, nor did he ever attempt to shame me into going back. There are a lot of good things I can say about my darling husband, but one of the most appreciated is that he respects the decisions I make for myself. But would you believe that it was 3 months before I was missed? Here I was, making this sacrificial statement by absenting myself, and nobody had noticed. Obviously, the church was progressing right along without me, and I use that word deliberately, for the church was getting so aggressively progressive that Pastor Ledbetter, now retired, petitioned the presbytery to reactivate him, and I was thinking of extending my sabbatical for another year. But I'm getting ahead of myself. The Cochrane House, three-fourths enclosed by a fence the likes of which no one had ever seen before, now sat empty and forlorn. No for rent or for sale signs were out front, and what had once been so prized by so many was now abandoned and tossed beside. Except by J.D. Pickens, who was consumed by worry over who would pick up the pieces. "No telling who'll move in next," he muttered, rubbing his hand over his mouth. I had stopped by to visit with Hazel Marie, expecting that they'd be rejoicing in seeing the last of a group home next door. "Why don't you buy it?" I ventured to ask. "That way you'd have some control over who your neighbors are." "I would," he said, "or try to anyway, but it's not on the market. No agent to contact, no owner of record except that strange corporation that nobody knows anything about. Or," he amended himself, "who'll admit to knowing?" I knew that because Mildred and I had put Tom LaSalle on the trail of an owner, someone who could sign a listing agreement, and he'd had no luck. I had a feeling that we might have to send Tom to Belize. But the strangest thing happened, or almost happened, a week before Christmas. Hazel Marie called to tell me that someone had moved into the Cochrane House. "Overnight, Miss Julia," she said, almost gasping for breath. "Yesterday nobody was there, but this morning somebody is. And would you believe they've got the windows covered with coats and towels and I don't know what all? And Lloyd said he saw a hippie-looking man with a backpack wheel a bicycle inside, and another one with long hair and tattoos all over him, and he had a backpack, too. And," she went on, "J.D. is beside himself because he says it's squatters who've moved in. And Miss Julia, I didn't think it could get any worse than a group home, but now it looks like it can." Well, of course, I was up in arms over the thought of unauthorized persons just taking over an empty house as if they owned it. Another instance of defying the law. What in the world were we coming to? But I'd not reckoned with J.D. Pickens, who with uncharacteristic restraint quickly solved the problem. He invited Sergeant Coleman Bates, and 10 or so of Coleman's fellow deputies, as well as the sheriff himself, to dinner at his house, requiring only that they come in full uniform. Abbott County Sheriff's Department cars, including 2 occupied canine vehicles, prominently parked in front of the Cochrane House, lined Jackson Street, 1 or 2 under no parking signs, and deputies in padded leather jackets walked back and forth along the sidewalk with that impressive creaking swagger that a duty belt heavy with firearm, handcuffs, taser, reloaders, and who knows what else inspires. Even though the temperature hovered around 40 degrees, Mr. Pickens grilled steaks outside, dancing in place as Lloyd's boombox played what passed for music. Over and over and at deafening levels, a song about somebody coming for the bad boys blared throughout the neighborhood, while Ronnie, dizzy with excitement, scampered across both yards. The Cochrane House was empty again the next morning, but our long-term problem with it wasn't solved. Tom LaSalle was sure that he'd eventually find an owner without going to Belize, although he wouldn't mind going if that's what it took. In the meantime, Great Dane Properties now owned 3 houses, and neither Mildred nor I knew what to do with them. When approached, Jan Osborne was delighted to stay where she was and rent from us, which of course obligated us to replace the roof and the furnace for her. Mr. Pickerel was grateful to be able to rent his house from us as well, as he'd not been able to find a suitable place for his wife. The Winsteads, however, who'd been the last to want to sell, were the first to move out. Mildred, who loved doing such things, was researching the history of their Tudor house and applying for listing on the National Registry of Historic Places, which meant we were in for a long restoration project to put it in its original condition. So what was our long-term plan for that block after we acquired the Cochrane house? We didn't have one. At this time, it was enough to have moved a group home and, according to Mr. Pickens, forestalled a drug house, thereby saving the neighborhood from a precipitous decline. I'd say that was a fairly good piece of work. It's a wonder to me how rumors, both true and false, first get started and then run rampant throughout the town. As closely as Sam, Binky, and I had guarded the secret of who owned the Victorian house on Wilson Avenue, somehow it had gotten out, and I had not even told Luann. Maybe somebody had looked it up at the Register of Deeds office, and now that I think of it, it had probably been Madge who'd done the research. And if so, I hope she felt chastened and chastised upon learning that her arch-enemy not only owned the house, but had made it available to her. I knew that the secret was no longer hidden the morning a couple of days before Christmas when I answered the phone and heard Helen Stroud's voice. "Julia," she said, "I'm calling to wish you a Merry Christmas and also to thank you for whatever you did to close down that group home. It just made me ill to think of all the time and effort I've spent on Thurlow's house when, for all I knew, a 7-Eleven convenience store would be springing up across the street." "Why, thank you, Helen," I said, wondering why she'd been so willing to raise funds for the house that she was now so glad to be rid of. I left that alone, though, for I recognized an effort to suspend hostilities when I saw one. "Like you," I went on, "I'm pleased to see the last of it in our vicinity, but I really didn't have much to do with it." "That's not what I hear. But be that as it may, I also wanted to ask if you'd be interested in a beautification project of our West Side neighborhood. I'd like to get all the residents involved in improving their yards and gardens." "Of course I'd be interested. What do you have in mind?" "Well, I have access to a wholesale nursery, and I was thinking that if everyone in the neighborhood would agree to plant several azaleas in their yards, we would be the most beautiful area in town. I know that most of us already have azaleas, but I'm thinking of creating an explosion of color for blocks around. Think how beautiful Charleston is in the spring." "That sounds wonderful, Helen. You can count me in." "Oh, good," she said, then with a deep breath went on, "I also wanted to ask if you would be the greeter at the front door when Thurlow's house is on the spring house tour." I noticed that she didn't mention who would benefit from the spring house tour, but as the Homes for Teens was no longer a sore spot for either of us, we could safely join forces to raise funds for it. Greeting at the front door was an honored position on a house tour, sort of on the same level as being asked to pour at a tea. So I took the invitation as an indication that Helen no longer held that ill-advised intervention against me, and I accepted with gratitude. I also had to adjust my thinking about Helen's relationship with Thurlow, for she had come up with a Christmas idea that showed her heart was in the right place. After consulting with Hazel Marie and Mr. Pickens, both of whom eagerly assisted her, she dropped in at their house for a few minutes every day or so in the weeks before Christmas. While there, she took pictures of Ronnie eating, Ronnie sleeping, Ronnie on guard, Ronnie playing with the little girls, Ronnie running around the yard, Ronnie doing everything except adoring Mr. Pickens, a sensitive decision that revealed Helen's concern for Thurlow's feelings. Then she put those pictures in a miniature computer-like device, a digital frame, Lloyd called it, that ran them like a movie for Thurlow's viewing pleasure. Helen's thoughtful care of the worst patient in the world, along with the phone call to me indicating that I was back in her good graces, lifted my spirits immeasurably. I had not realized how deeply her animus toward me had darkened my life until it was removed. In my euphoria over a renewed friendship, I could almost, but not quite, forgive the church its headlong rush to be all things to all people. But there was still Luann, and she weighed heavily on my mind, especially now that Helen had graciously forgiven me for the same kind of humiliation I was holding against Luann. I sat at the folding table in the guest room, wrapping the last small gifts late on the day before Christmas Eve. I had vacillated about sending a present to Luann this year. She knew how deeply offensive she had been by luring me to that so-called prayer meeting, knowing what was going to happen. I had thought at the time that I could never forgive her, but Helen had forgiven me for the same offense. Could I not now do the same? Yes, I decided I could, but unfortunately, I had ordered Luann's gift while I was still furious with her. Even Neiman Marcus couldn't manage a mailed exchange this close to Christmas. So I sat and studied my usual, though slightly different, gift to her. Every year I gave her a box set of bath powder with a small bottle of Joy by Jean Patou Parfum. This year, however, as I couldn't pretend that nothing had happened between us, I had ordered the box of bath powder, but had changed the parfum to Eau de Toilette. I knew she would recognize the downgrade. Well, I thought, sighing, it was either that or nothing. So I wrapped them up and promised myself to make it up to her on her birthday. If, that is, she didn't run roughshod over my feelings again. We were late getting to bed on Christmas Eve, but it had been a lovely day of short visits to various friends to drop off gifts, ending with an intimate eggnog party at Mildred's. We would be going to Hazel Marie's early on Christmas morning for breakfast and to see what Santa had brought the children. They would then come to our house for a mid-afternoon dinner, which Lillian had been preparing for days. She and Letitia would be with us not only through dinner, but afterward, too, when we would have another great unwrapping of the gifts that waited under our tree. "Phew," Sam said as he turned off the lamp and sank back onto the pillow. "It's been a long day. A nice one, but long. And getting up early in the morning means facing another long one. I'm getting too old for all this socializing."
"Oh, don't say that, Sam. With that young heart of yours, you'll never be too old. Besides," I went on, already looking forward to the morrow, "we'll have time for a nap between breakfast and dinner. Although I dislike making plans for a nap before even starting the day, it's a sign of age, and I don't like it."
"Well, me either, but I do like the naps."
We laughed a little at that and snuggled down, getting ready for sleep. After a few minutes, Sam said,
"Julia?"
"Hmm?"
"When you were little, did you ever lie in bed imagining Santa Claus landing his sleigh on the roof?"
"Not only imagined it, I could hear tiny little hooves tapping on the housetop."
"Well, how would you like it if Santa came early this year?"
"That would be nice, I guess, but why would he?"
He laughed and reached for me.
"Come over here and I'll show you."
The End. This book was read for you by Cynthia Darlow, a member of SAG-AFTRA. We hope you've enjoyed this production of Miss Julia Raises the Roof by Anne B. Ross. Recorded books are available wherever audiobooks are sold, including Audible.com, Audiobooks.com, Apple iTunes, and in public libraries through RB Digital. Thank you for being a Recorded Books reader.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.